Hello and welcome to Step by Step, a podcast by Future Commerce presented by Avalara. I'm Philip.
And I'm Brian. And this is season 7 of Step by Step. And you're listening to episode 2 of 5. So you're just jumping in a little bit ahead of the game. Potentially, you might want to go back and listen to episode 1.
Always.
This is a full 5-part series, and we're talking with experts from industry-leading cross-border platforms and technologies that power cross-border innovation, and we're bringing that to you step by step.
Yeah, and we're trying to answer the big thorny question, when is the right time for my brand to go cross-border? I like to say e-commerce today is an investment, right, versus an asset. And an investment in a channel, especially a new channel that's in an emerging market for you as a brand, how do you get maximize an investment? Brian Lang, this is not investment advice. Don't take advice from us, but time in market, right? Time in market. And so speed to market is of the utmost importance, but you don't want to risk having a failed launch, and you don't want to set yourself back by doing some of the wrong things, and you can implement cross-border the wrong way. And so this season, we're going to help you think about the things that you should consider before taking your steps to grow your brand overseas. And if you've maybe taken some of those first steps, or maybe you've performed some tests, but now cross-border is a key part of that growth strategy for you, well, stay tuned, because this podcast is for you.
Speaking of time and market, our upcoming guest, who I'm so excited about, has had some time in the market of going international. Kent Allen is like OG internationalization. Yeah. Like this guy is a wizard in going cross-border.
one of the early founders of Guelph, which is the Global E-Commerce Leaders Forum, and a principal at the Research Trust. One of the incredible things is that Kent literally wrote the book on cross-border and performed original research in the early 2000s that we all still depend on today about the right and wrong way to enter into a new market. We have put this entire series together and taken a lot of great pains to make sure that we have accurate information from people who have been doing this for decades. I have been so educated, and I've been in e-commerce for 20 years. I think that we are putting together one of the most definitive point in time pieces of content about cross-border that exists in our ecosystem today.
Agreed.
But we're doing it for a purpose, and that's because brands are expanding globally right now.
Yeah.
There's no time to waste.
There's no time to waste. The opportunity is just too high. The cost of CAC in local markets is just, it's astronomical. And so as you learn in this theory, is like the opportunity to go acquire new customers in different regions is really, really like, it's a great opportunity. It is a good investment if you do it right. So that's why we did this season of Step by Step in partnership with Avalara to help you understand how to get to those new regions, but do it in a way that is good for your customers and good for your business. And that's not an easy feat. There's so much complexity when going cross-border. You know, it's beyond just translating your e-commerce site.
Yep.
It's having to consider all these other things like taxes, duties, shipping, cultural differences, and so much more.
Yeah. So if you are an operator and you have questions about how to take those next steps, or maybe you're in technology and you're curious about the kind of tech stack that you might need for an international launch, this series is for you. Why wait any further? Let's get to the good stuff. We're going to join Kent Allen, who's principal of the Research Trust and co-founder of the Global E-Commerce Leaders Forum, as we dive into the topic and ask the questions and find out the answers that we need to successfully launch brands into new markets step by step. Today, we are joined in our second episode of this ongoing series about going cross-border. We're joined by a retail e-commerce industry analyst who has been in this ecosystem, who's been leading us into this conversation around cross-border for 25 years. Mr. Kent Allen is the principal of the Research Trust and co-founder of Global E-commerce Leaders Forum, or GELF for short. Welcome to the show, Kent.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. We're excited to talk to you about selling cross-border. You have many years of experience in international commerce. Talk to us just really quickly about, you know, what GELF is and the point of GELF.
Yeah, sure. GELF really kind of grew out of some work we were doing literally a couple of decades ago, back when e-commerce and the store teams were still trying to get their executives, you know, quite literally on the same page. And we were doing a symposium actually at shop.org. And the question came up, well, you know, hey, the World Wide Web is by definition worldwide. And, you know, we're starting to see more traffic come from international. We don't know how they're finding us. But, you know, I think we need to think about this. So that was really kind of the first heads up to us that we needed to kind of start thinking less about how to get e-commerce in the U.S. to work. But also, again, how do you deal with people coming in, crossing borders from all over the world? So this was probably 2007, 2008 or so. And so we decided, you know, let's spend some time looking at that. At the time, I was working with another GELF co-founder, Jim Okamura, who has been in the cross-border, cross-channel consulting world for a long time. And really kind of the output of our attempt to answer that question was really the first benchmarking study that we published at shop.org, I think back in 2007, 2008. And we just kind of took off from there. And, you know, interestingly enough, we thought that cross-border and investing in international would be the next big thing back then. But as it turned out, the next big thing was actually the Great Recession. And that hit, hit everybody hard, including e-commerce, which was still, you know, that was back in the, you know, 2018, 19, 20% annual growth years. And, you know, so coming out of that, the world of the iPhone kind of dawned. And if you guys remember, all the money went into mobile commerce and things like that. Yeah. So in a weird way, you know, cross-border and international took a little bit of a hiatus as everybody rushed to figure out mobile commerce.
Well, now, Kent, you click a button in your Shopify app and you're instantly cross-border. So it's been good talking to you. And no, I'm just kidding. It's still complicated. It's not easy, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not. In fact, you know, again, we saw the complexity out of the great, you know, 20 years or so ago. The interesting thing was once the traffic started coming in from mobile devices all around the world, people were like, oh, okay, we've kind of opened up this, I don't know if you'd call it a Pandora's box or not, because it was actually a world of opportunity. But yeah, you're right. I mean, fast forward to today and, you know, even the folks like Shopify have, you know, realized that, hey, it's not just about getting really functional sites up and going that, you know, focus on an in-country population. We've got to realize that the very nature of digital commerce is cross-border. So it's actually been really kind of refreshing to see how people have embraced this idea, especially coming out of this, you know, this really rough patch that we've had for 2 years where borders have been closed and people have kind of hunkered down. And yet, obviously, there's been a boom in e-commerce, and we've definitely seen an eco boom in cross-border as well, or an echo boom, I should say.
If you had launched cross border in 2008, you know, the global population that was e-commerce enabled back then was much smaller than it is today, right? And we've seen a lot of leapfrogging of technology, you know, especially mobile first. You see what's happened in the Africas, and what an incredible time to be launching. The cross border joke in here is back then you would have been launching de minimis, and today you're launching De Maximus. Thank you. I'll be here all week.
All right. I'll have to use that one before. But yes, you know, from 2008 to 2000, you know, say 2018, you know, obviously a lot of growth in e-commerce, but to some extent, even a maturing of that growth. Then along came the pandemic. And what happened was that all the pockets of resistance, if you want to call it, or the laggards, And, you know, great example, you know, Southern Europe, for instance, traditionally fairly low penetration, or relatively low, I should say, from an e-commerce perspective. But, you know, as we all know, you know, Italy got hit early and really hard by the pandemic, and, you know, Spain, Portugal, we saw a lot of that kind of remnant population come online. Same thing happened in Latin America, where obviously, you know, especially on the social side of things, people have been very active online, but, you know, huge bump due to the pandemic. And, you know, the question now is, okay, does this laggard population that's come online, do they stick? Do they go back to the stores? Is a little bit of both? And I think the answer is, yeah, it's going to stick. Obviously, stores are going to benefit, but, you know, digital and stores are increasingly intertwined today. So, you know, if you're thinking cross-border e-commerce, you know, you've also got to be thinking the roles of stores as far as cross-border fulfillment, your DCs all over the world. It's a complex picture for sure.
It's complex, but, you know, when I, you know, the way that it works as a consumer, I just go on someone's website and I click, you know, order from, you know, this really cool international brand I found. And then I pay some exorbitant shipping fee. And then it, like 6 weeks later, I have a product show up my doorstep, right, Kent? is that how it works? Wow.
You've kind of created quite, yeah, we could probably do an entire hour just on, you know, where the shipping costs are. But yes, I mean, again, looking back, say, you know, we'll just say 10 years or so ago, yeah, that was always one of the biggest challenges. And to be honest, one of the reasons the cross-border experience has always been, you know, kind of not what it should be, especially when you compare it to a domestic e-commerce experience. It was always super high, expensive shipping and long delays. Now, you could certainly, you know, pay a lot for express shipping and you could get it there in 2 or 3 days. But, you know, what we found over the years as we did more research was, you know, yes, there was the, you know, call it the wealthy expatriate who just wants what they want and they want it as soon as they can. And they're not too worried about paying whatever it takes to get it. That's a relatively small segment, but, you know, to be honest, that did nurture the first generation of cross-border e-commerce. More recently, it's been, you know, call it the rising global middle class that has really, you know, kind of shored up the opportunity. And we do see research and continue to see that today where, you know, in many cases, people are willing to wait to get, you know, a better shipping price. I'm not going to say a cheap shipping price because international is still challenging. Now, again, this is all pre-pandemic. You look at what's happened with the shipping cost during the pandemic, and this impacts, you know, this is supply chain, this is direct to consumer e-commerce, this is everything. We've seen some data where, you know, shipping, you know, just capacity has quadrupled in cost. So international shipping is unfortunately a challenge for everybody today, whether it's e-commerce or just, you know, getting product to put on the shelves of stores.
No, there's the funny thing about this whole conversation is if you're a branded manufacturer or even a retailer, you're used to having to deal with international shipping. You're just putting it in, you know, giant containers on freight. And that's costing 6, 7 times, 8 times more than it used to as well. Now we're talking about consumer. So there's tons of pitfalls, I'm sure. What are some things that, you know, folks just don't consider or implement poorly and have to wind up ripping and replacing later on when they start down their cross-border journey?
Yeah, you know, since we're talking about shipping, and you're right, you know, there has been a push to fill containers and put them on ships. But, you know, largely a lot of direct-to-consumer e-commerce that has been fulfilled internationally has still, you know, really taken advantage of air freight. So, you know, early on in the pandemic, you know, people were relying on there being passenger jets taking passengers around the world. And when that all shut down, guess what went away? Of course, all that air capacity. So, yeah, I mean, one of the, and I don't know if I'd call it rip and replace, but certainly one of the things that people have had to revisit is just this whole idea of, you know, where do we find the capacity to ship the products? And, you know, so at the same time, you've got this rise in e-commerce volume, you've got this echo boom I was talking about in cross-border, and yet, you know, the capacity was gone. So people have had to do some really nimble and innovative things. And what I think you saw a lot during the past holidays was a lot of smart brands went out and secured their own capacity. They didn't really rely on their 3PLs. Maybe they worked with their 3PLs. But yeah, they knew that, you know, I've got to make sure that I can get my product where it needs to be. So that's one thing. I think looking at some of the other opportunities, one thing that we've certainly seen, and I'll stick with the shipping infrastructure right now, is in the early days of cross-border, for the most part, especially U.S. retailers, they just kind of turned to their, you know, trusted domestic shipping partners. And those shipping partners didn't always have the international lanes developed, say, into South Korea or into Southern Europe, as we mentioned earlier, or even to your point earlier, some of the emerging markets like Nigeria and things like that. So just kind of handing off an international order to a domestic shipper really drove up costs and things like that. So I think one of the things that people are really focusing on right now is really understanding, you know, how to bring in, say, you know, kind of multi-carrier shipping solutions and understanding how better to kind of get a good price for the end consumer by, you know, doing a little bit more sophisticated brokering. And sometimes that's increasingly being driven by AI and machine learning. So that would just be one thing. Lots of other things we can talk about.
Yeah, I actually, one of those things could be that there's it's been said at least once before that when you're talking about international air, it's really people in yellow or people in brown. But are there actually more options than just that? There must be. Yeah.
One of the things that we've seen at some of our Global E-commerce Leader events or GELF, as you guys mentioned in the opening, is, you know, you are getting a lot of these specialists. I know I was just talking to Singapore Airlines a couple of weeks ago, and they've got Parcel is what they're calling their service. And, you know, we're certainly see, you know, essentially you're seeing manufacturing moving beyond China into parts of Southeast Asia, which is, of course, raising the standard of living. And there's more, you know, kind of, you know, the rising middle class there. And of course, the first thing they want to do is kind of upgrade their lifestyle. So, you know, yes, they can buy locally sometimes, but in many cases, you know, they want that authentic purchase, so they'll purchase cross border. So, yeah, that's that the specialists are interesting. You see that, you know. In fact, I was even talking to Russia Post not too long ago, and you know, obviously, oh, wow, there's issues there, and there have been. I somewhat haphazardly called 2014 the year of Russian cross border, and unfortunately, they crossed the border into Crimea, and that kind of fell apart on me. So I don't always get my calls right, but
well, you got it right. You just, it wasn't what you meant. It's almost the monkey paw of cross border is. You have to be extremely specific when manifesting things in the e-commerce world.
You look at different parts of Asia, you look at South America, and in fact, one thing that we find that U.S. e-commerce leaders don't necessarily think about as much, or maybe the leaders do and the laggards are just coming around to it. And it's really one of the justifications for cross-border in general, which is this idea that, yeah, it may not be as profitable as your domestic. In fact, more often than not, it's not as profitable. And that's one of the big challenges that, you know, the CFOs face is like, why shouldn't we just keep investing in the U.S. market? You know, we know how to get a better return there. And I think part of the answer to that is like, well, yeah, if we ignore opportunities, you know, throughout Latin America, you know, we're going to find in 10 years that the lane from China into South America, which is a booming lane, by the way, and has been growing, is going to pretty much shut us out of the market. So in some ways, we've always, you know, kind of pitched, if you will, cross-border e-commerce as a diversification play, as an opportunity to be relevant to your consumer of the next decade consumer. And that more likely than not is going to be this rising middle class around the world. So there's a lot more to it than just running the numbers sometimes. But yeah, the shipping lanes that we're seeing out of different parts of Asia into Latin America, for instance, should really be seen as a red flag to U.S. brands that are, you know, kind of maybe focusing a little bit too much on their domestic markets.
I'm fascinated actually at this, how US centric, you know, my mindset can be. I do most of the work I do is with, domestic e-commerce brands that are looking to go out. But when you're speaking to someone in Canada, they're all too used to having to deal with cross-border and DAP and all the rest, right? They're used to having a poor consumer experience on the receiving end. What I think I hear you saying is that, maybe if in the not too distant future, you know, there are more markets that, more brands from, you know, outside of the United States are servicing, in a true global economy rather than just a US to the rest of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Canada, you know, as much as you will hear China when it comes to cross-border e-commerce, and, you know, obviously China is a hugely important market, you know, Canada is still our number one trading partner. And interestingly enough, you know, we've certainly seen that the Canadian consumer, especially in the last 5 years, really kind of adapt e-commerce. I don't know if catch up is the right word, but, you know, people would say that. And, you know, but the Canadian border is, you know, certainly not as easy as it could be. So, you know, we definitely see a lot of opportunities for both the Canadian consumer, who is very used to, you know, shopping in the U.S. and dealing with cross-border.
Oh, yeah.
But we're also seeing, you know, an opportunity for small Canadian brands to connect with U.S. customers, especially U.S. consumers that, you know, might be tired of, you know, kind of the same domestic offerings that they see at the local mall or, you know, can buy on Amazon. And I mean, it's interesting. We actually did some work for the Canadian Trade Department. And I know one of the things that, that U.S. consumers find very appealing about Canadian brands is that they're very sustainable, they're very eco-centric. And so there's lots of opportunities like that for, you know, brands outside the U.S. to kind of appeal to U.S. consumers. Again, something else that U.S.-based retail e-commerce brands need to think about.
Are you considering selling to international customers? I think you are, because you are listening to this season of Step by Step. We have partnered with Avalara to create a 40-page merchant's guide to cross-border commerce. This new step-by-step guide will take you through all of the things that you need to consider when putting people, processes, and platforms into place to have a winning cross-border strategy. Cross-border sales are a great way to increase your customer base and drive revenue and position your brand for the future, but it's not without complexity. You have to consider the customer experience. You have to have a comprehensive timeline. You have to understand compliance, custom duties, and tax requirements. And you have to work with a wealth of partners. Our 8-step 40-page guide will help you to do that and create a winning cross-border strategy. Download the guide for free right now at futurecommerce.fm/crossborder. That's futurecommerce.fm/crossborder, and get your 40-page 8-step guide, a merchant's guide to cross-border commerce, right now. That's right, futurecommerce.fm/crossborder. Let's talk a little bit about how things can go wrong. What are some elements of maybe bad advice that, you know, retailers or brands might get from various sources, and or maybe even some areas where they may fall prey to fraud or something that might land them in trouble?
If somebody asks me, you know, what are the first five things I need to think about for cross-border, you know, all those answers are going to be not so sexy and going to be very operational in order. It's going to be, you've got to understand that there's a lot of fraudsters out there.
Sure.
And especially, and it's not always fraud too, you know, sometimes an order can look a little suspicious, but that's simply because of the way that your fraud detection systems are set up, which are largely geared to kind of look for issues in the U.S. and things like that. This is a suspicious address. Well, that's because addresses in most of the world don't look like U.S. addresses. So definitely fine tuning your fraud detection. And, you know, we've had the guys from Signify provided our events for years, and they do a great job at really kind of helping people understand that it's not just about knocking out fraud, but it's about understanding all those really good orders that may look like fraudulent. So yeah, don't bite the hand that feeds you, or whatever the right saying is. But yeah, you make a great point. You know, you gotta get your fraud screening, and you know, the solution partners that are out there that help you with that, you know, they understand where the fraudsters are. I remember we did this whole session on the dark web, and it was just crazy, some of the stories that they were able to share with you. And you know, again, probably a topic for another day. Obviously, the next second piece is payments. Payments are so important, and again, something that domestic U.S. resellers, especially you know, marketplace sellers and things like that may not have the deep pockets that some of the bigger brands and retailers that are servicing a global market might have. You've got to understand that there's so many different payments. I mean, you know, people talk about Germany. Oh, they like the bank transfers. The mobile wallets are something that are increasingly important, especially in Asia, where you've got WeChat Pay and you've got Alipay. So again, a topic for another day, but really make sure that you understand what can go wrong on the payment side of things. Because if you're just offering them U.S. domestic, credit card options, you're going to see a big hit to the conversion rates for sure. So, you know, those are a couple of things that can go wrong. I think the one that, you know, you probably learned about in international marketing back in high school or college or whatever was, you know, all the cultural stuff. And, you know, there's always the stories of, you know, how cars were misnamed for the market south of the border and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they turned out to be called Little Junkster or something like that. But the cultural stuff is actually really huge. And a big part of that cultural piece is really just understanding that you've got to localize your content, whether it's photos or text. And especially as we see more and more kind of lifestyle selling and, you know, the power of the image, that can actually be a really good workaround for not saying the wrong thing and not putting too much time and effort into your translations, which, you know, are increasingly machine driven. And that's got a whole bevy of challenges there as well. But yeah, understanding the cultural nuances, understanding that, you know, the days that you might be celebrating holidays in your domestic market don't line up with, you know, with other folks as well. So I could go on and on there, but I'll bounce it back to you guys.
There's an interesting challenge when you're thinking about just the diversity of all these carriers, all these payments options. Whenever, you know, I encounter a brand who's tested the waters and they want to go to scale now, they're usually looking for the least hands to shake. And it doesn't seem like there's an easy way to get around having fewer hands to shake. What kind of an organizational upskilling or maturity is required on the retailer or brand side as they, you know, try to deliver into more regions?
It's a great point. How many cooks in the kitchen? What hands are there? And I should preface my answer by saying that one of the biggest mistakes that we've seen over the years is that very often brands think they can just kind of go global on their own. They're like, oh, well, you know, my domestic carrier has international, so we'll just work with them and we'll kind of figure it out as it goes. And yeah, some people can make that happen, but anybody that really values their brand and understands that, you know, you're going into a, you know, what could be a huge future market for you. So you really should bring in some people that know what they're doing, whether it's the cross-border platforms, the folks that are specialized on international checkout and understand harmonization, taxation, you know, all the nitty gritty of making sure that, you know, taxes and tariffs are paid. So there's not this unpleasant surprise when, you know, somebody's been waiting for a week and a half for this, you know, cherished item to show up, only, you know, gets this big extra bill at the door, which is, you know, not the way to go. But yeah, there's a lot I could unpack in that question for sure.
You know, as we're sort of thinking through then about how you go about choosing partners, you know, you mentioned one, you know, we're partnered with Signified as well. They've done some great work over the years with us and in the various brands that we've partnered with, both for domestic and for cross-border. How do you tell the difference in partners between, you know, a service provider, like a full scale service provider, and sort of like maybe piecemealing, you know, trying to pull together your own solution by, you know, taking on the burden yourself to try to bring this in house? And maybe at what point do you have to recognize as a brand what kind of a partner you need to go cross border?
Yeah, and I'll actually kind of finish answering your first question before I get to that one. But
sure.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it does come down to how you're organizing internally. So I think what we've seen over the years is that there's been this push and pull between centralization and decentralization. And by centralization, that means that most of the decisions and most of the strategy and the tactics are kind of developed back at headquarters and kind of pushed out to the in-market teams, if you will. You know, the decentralized approach, which, you know, in many cases, I think works best, is empowering those local, you know, the country teams. So, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about understanding cultural nuances and things like that. You know, if you're depending on your people at HQ, you know, you're going to stumble there. So empowering those market people. As far as the partnering part, I mean, that's a challenging one. And a lot of times it's very market specific. So if you look at Japan, for instance, Japan is always looked at as, you know, well, we've got our Japan team and they're kind of separate from everything. Japan very much does operate as its own market. And in many cases, you don't have a whole lot of option other than using your in-country team there. And in fact, you'll find that your partners can be very Japan-centric. China's a little bit different. Absolutely, you need boots on the ground there. And we've had people go back and forth between whether they've got boots on the ground and not. And, you know, sometimes it can work both ways. But what we have found works really well in China is, one, making sure that you've got a good trusted partner there. I was talking to the guys over at Burton not too long ago, and, you know, they've done a great job of building out their international e-commerce business. But, you know, during the pandemic, they were like, hey, we had to really empower our Chinese partners, our trade partners, or TPs, as they're called. And it's paid off for them. So that having been said, you know, I think it is important to have strong leadership in your domestic market. So there's almost this balance between decentralization and centralization that you really have to hit. And usually it's kind of developing a center of excellence. And there's lots of different flavors and brands of that. And again, even in your centers of excellence, there's this, okay, how much of that is outsourced to the market teams or the regional teams versus headquarters. So it's interesting. And it's a tough question to answer there, but I would say that, we have seen the partnering approach work. Certainly, you know, we've seen some of the cross-border platforms like Global-e went public recently. Sure. And just acquired Flow. The eShopworld guys or the ESW folks have done a good job in the past. And then you've got folks like Avalara who have, you know, probably have some of the most sophisticated technology where it really matters most. So I think what companies need to understand is that, you know, yes, you probably do need call it a general contractor type platform partner, but you're going to have to be working with a lot of specialists. And again, back to the part, the discussion we had about developing trade lanes, sometimes you're going to have to go out and build the relationships directly with those different, you know, shipping partners. If you're going into South Korea or you're going into, you know, potential parts of Eastern Europe, I mean, we're seeing some impressive, you know, growth out of Poland, for instance. We talked about Southern Europe and then, you know, Africa and the Middle East, you know, whole new ball game there, especially in the Middle East. Lots going on there today.
What do you think the future for, you know, mid-size enterprise brands are in sort of trying to get incremental growth via cross-border? Is there an opportunity to kind of give them some sage advice? It sounds like, yeah, hey, they're already building their own teams, you know, and capabilities. They're already partnering with external expertise. They're already building relationships with technology platforms and managing all these relationships in market. You know, what else could there be that's next?
When we did our very first benchmark study, one of our top line conclusions was that cross-border and international expansion, the companies that are best positioned to do this are the smaller specialty, or maybe not smaller, but specialty retailers, if you will. And in large part, that's because what people were looking for, and again, this was, you know, almost 15, 20 years or so ago, what they were looking for is just products that, you know, they just couldn't get locally, or if they could get them locally, you know, they were way, way more expensive. Even if they bought it and paid a, you know, arm and a leg to have it shipped and dealt with all the tariffs and things like that, it's still going to be cheaper. And part of the reason that we were saying that the specialty retailers have always had the best opportunity was in large part because some of the bigger brands. And again, when we started Gelf, it was mostly still retailers and things like that. So the Macy's of the world going into China, which, you know, in the end, you know, didn't end up being a great fit because, you know, the marketplaces in China are really kind of, they're the department store, if you will. They're bringing in all the brands and they're the middleman and they're getting it out to the, you know, to the consumer. So, specialty brands have a great opportunity. I would also suggest that, you know, don't think that you just have to go direct to consumer. You don't just have to work with one of these cross-border e-commerce platforms. Marketplaces are a huge opportunity. In fact, you know, a whole nother topic for another day probably is working with the Amazons of the world, or the Mercado Libres, or the Zalandos, or, you know, JD and Alibaba in Asia, not to mention all the different folks down in Southeast Asia. So, you know, working with marketplaces is another extremely important. In fact, you know, we've got our framework, and there's really kind of, you know, three phases or three steps. One of them is, you know, kind of understanding how to adapt your domestic operations so that you can quickly, easily fulfill international orders from your domestic, you know, distribution centers, or increasingly drop shipping and things like that. Again, another topic for another day. And doing so with at least a decent enough customer experience. But then you look at the marketplace channels. In many cases, marketplaces is where you want to go. So you can take your direct-to-consumer cross-border and, you know, maybe think of that as fulfilling the demand that's coming to you, the people that are finding you. But when you're ready to kind of go into new markets and, you know, you need to find customers and things like that, marketplaces, you know, are usually the best way to do it. Now, there's another wrinkle, too, that we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years is that, especially for the large global brands, they're finding that working with the Alibabas and the Amazons and the Mercado Libres and so forth and whatnot offers them a great opportunity to offset some of the challenges that they're seeing in their traditional wholesale channel, where they may have, you know, to your point earlier, they may have just put a couple of containers on a ship and, you know, there's a distributor in Spain or Portugal and they pretty much own the market. And it's really, they take the product and get it to the consumer from there. In many cases, we find that some of these master wholesale partners aren't as, you know, up to snuff, if you will, on the digital side. So we've seen over the years, more and more brands starting to work with the marketplaces and the Amazons and things like that to do a better job of really essentially turning those marketplace platforms into a new class of master distributor, master wholesaler, if you will. And I think the last thing to look at too is, you know, and this is where, you know, where Shopify comes in and other folks like Shopify is, you know, they are people that are going to want to buy locally, and you know, being able to set up, you know, regional or in-country sites is hugely important. Maybe not as much in Asia, certainly not in China, where marketplaces rule. But we've had plenty of e-commerce leaders tell us, hey, you know, we are always going to have a direct-to-consumer site ready for China because you never know what's going to happen. You know, they've right. described it as the keeping the porch light on strategy, where you know, if there's a decision that comes out of the government, and we've certainly seen a lot of that recently out of China, they want to be able to, you know, kind of shift from, you know, some constraint on a marketplace selling into going direct to consumer. So sorry, long answer there, guys.
Oh, geez. No, it's the best kind of answer, because I think it really it answers the question. Well, it kind of depends. It depends on where you're going, what you're trying to do. And at the end of the day, I kind of hear in there that you don't just flippantly launch cross-border as a means of incremental growth, but you need an omni-channel strategy in region, just in the same way you have an omni-channel strategy domestically. And I think that really kind of sums up the challenge of, well, you're this isn't just an avenue to have more people buy your products, but it's an avenue for you to actually expand your business, and your business operations are more than just your storefront.
One of the biggest opportunities right now, and whether you want to call it omni-channel or, I don't know, omni-customer maybe is a better way of looking at it, is, yeah, you know, that there's going to be challenges. And again, we talked about the high cost of international shipping right now. And we're certainly, we're telling, folks that come to our events and things like that, you know, it's not just about, shipping domestically anymore. You need to look at figuring out, as one speaker put it, at a recent event, the holy grail for us is just being able to drop ship from the point of creation to the point of in demand. Now, there's a lot that goes into that. Obviously, distribution centers and the hub and spoke, fulfillment models and things like that have all been built around, the realities of commerce. But yeah, ultimately, what you want to be able to do is, figure out a way to capture demand, whether that's investing in your social channels or, your typical domestic marketing or search or whatever. It's like, capturing that demand, but then ideally fulfilling that demand as closely to that consumer as you can. So yes, we've looked at omni-channel fulfillment, and that's still very, very early from a global perspective. But yeah, if you've got product in country, that's already going to get past some of the challenges like sizing in Japan and things like that. So yes, if you could figure out how to, capture your order online and then just have it fulfilled by a local partner, whether that's a distribution partner or an end retailer, or even, I've told this story forever. When one of my first, kind of fun cross-border stories was talking to actually a small company that was selling sunglasses, and, they ended up shipping this, urgent order to somebody in China. And as it turned out, I think the guy paid like $150, probably for like a $20 pair of sunglasses. And the end recipient of the sunglasses, lived 2 miles from the factory in China where it was built. So of course they brought the sunglasses all the way to the US, turned around and shipped them back to the guy who was, 2 miles away from the factory where they were built. But maybe it was 20 miles, but anyway. kind of connecting those dots and figuring out how to get drop shipping involved and different modes of distributed order management, distributed fulfillment. Those are some of the cool things that people are working on now.
There's I can't think of a better way for us to frame for the Future Commerce podcast in our series Step-by-Step to frame what the future of cross-border looks like than by the person who literally wrote the book on the future of cross-border commerce. What an incredible conversation. Any last or finals from you, Kent? Something that we can leave people with?
Yeah, it can be really complex. It can be expensive. It can be challenging. But, don't be overcome by, the complexities. Don't be perplexed to the point where you sit on the fence. I think that some of the companies that have benefited most from being early and visionary and, extending the digital reach into international markets have been those people that aren't just sitting on the fence. You get a lot of retailers that are just going to wait and see what other people do. And you're starting to see that with brands and even the, the innovative direct-to-consumer brands. So it's like, don't sit on the fence, You got to do something, and it's totally fine to take one step at a time. Hey, if you want to work with your domestic fulfillment partner to start international, there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah, they're going to be, the experience isn't going to be as great, but start where you've got traction and go from there. A lot of what we talk about at Guelph events is very operational in focus. We talked earlier about fraud, payments, you know, making sure that you can tabulate tariffs and harmonization and all the, you know, good stuff that people like Avalara help you with. Then you've got the whole post-order fulfillment, but that whole operational piece, that's only part of it. And largely that's become, that's because of, you know, this first or second generation of cross-border have all been about, you know, fulfilling demand that, you know, comes to you, the organic stuff. There's a huge opportunity to get out there and connect with new shoppers and, you know, find people that are in this, you know, rising global middle class. And that's, I think, where you're going to see a lot of social come into it. I know we've been working with the Facebook and the Meta Disruptors team, and they're doing some cool stuff with Discovery Commerce. So, you know, don't overlook the need to focus on top of the funnel. And I guess maybe the last thing is, again, you know, don't be fat and happy sitting here, you know, doing what you're doing in the U.S. or in your own domestic market, because, you know, that's challenging, but it's easy compared to international. But if you ignore international, others aren't, and you're going to lose markets in the future. And that's really kind of the takeaway. You've got to have a kind of more holistic global view of the world.
A more holistic global view of the world. That's what selling cross-border is all about. And I can't believe that this was only the second episode. I feel like we went on a journey. Kent, it's been amazing having you. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom.
Hey, thanks, guys. And yeah, I mean, if any of your listeners are interested, we've got our next event in LA, April 21st. We'll be in West Hollywood. And, you know, we'll be pulling together the West Coast e-commerce community. So, you know, people can reach out to me if they want to get involved.
Where can they reach out to you?
You can always send me an email at kent@globalecommerce.co. So that's .co. So kent@globalecommerce.co. And we'll take it from there.
Thank you so much, Kent. And thank you all so much for listening to this second episode of the seventh season of Step by Step.